Welcome to the Poem of the Week. As you know, poems are patient-oriented evidence that matters. Each week, our poem is intended to help you practice the best, most current medicine by alerting you to studies that could change your practice. As usual, our host this week is National Public Radio's Dr. Michael Wilkes, and he is joined by InfoPoem's senior editor, Dr. Mark Abell. Gentlemen.
Hello, Mark. How are you doing?
Good. Good, Mike.
Good. I hope you had a good night's sleep, and if you didn't, we're going to talk about what we can do to improve your sleep. This week, we're going to focus on the concept of insomnia and specifically looking at treating a persistent insomnia. Just a little bit of background. Insomnia is generally approached in two different ways, depending on whether it's short-term insomnia, say less than 3 weeks, or long-term insomnia. Short-term insomnia, probably has a role for behavioral approaches, but perhaps more of a role for medication than in chronic problems. Again, there are some major myths that need to be expelled in terms of how much sleep a person actually needs. I'm not gonna read you the tables, but in general, a 15 or 16-year-old needs about 8 hours of sleep, and an 80-year-old needs about 5.5 hours of sleep. And so as we age, we need less sleep, and if we're fixated on the exact number of hours, that can cause lots of problems. We want to focus clearly in both the long-term and the short-term on any physical or psychological conditions. This concept of sleep hygiene that most of our listeners will know about is clearly important. You know, things like getting to sleep at the same time each day, not napping, having a routine, not having a TV in the bedroom, no stimulants, exercising during the day but not before bedtime, no big meals. Those are all very important, but you know, for the most part, someone who comes to the doctor has already tried most of those things, and they haven't been successful. In terms of medical problems, you know, there are sort of three big categories: sleep apnea, narcolepsy, and hypersomnia. You know, all of them relatively rare. Probably sleep apnea is the most common, and again, something we should keep in mind in terms of the patients that come to us. Last tidbit before we get to the article is I have had some good luck using sleep diaries, something that I ask someone to keep track of what they do starting six hours before they go to bed. I have them do that for 2 weeks and then come back. And you know, not infrequently, there are patterns and things that the patient and I can pick up that need to be altered. But when all of this fails and you've done everything that you've been taught, the question is, what's next? This is an article that was published in JAMA. Again, it asks the question, what is the optimal combination of medication and cognitive behavioral therapy for treating persistent insomnia in adults? Mark, a complicated study. What did the authors actually do and find?
Yeah, interesting study. I mean, I think I don't generally have much trouble sleeping, but when I do, I my version of counting sheep is to replay the last round of golf that I played and try to think about every shot and how I could have managed the course better, and usually by about the sixth hole I've passed out.
Because I actually listened to the last poem. Only kidding.
Anyway, this is, they had 180 adults, mean age 52 years. They met standard criteria for chronic insomnia. The poor people had been having a mean of 16 years of chronic insomnia. They were initially randomized to get either cognitive behavioral therapy alone or CBT plus Zolpidem 10 milligrams nightly, Ambien. After 6 weeks, patients receiving CBT alone were again randomized to get either CBT for another 6 months or no additional treatment, while those in the CBT plus Ambien group were randomized to get CBT alone for 6 months or CBT plus Ambien on an as-needed basis. CBT consisted of instructions to go to bed only when you're sleepy, kind of hygiene type things, use the bed and bedroom only for sleep and sex, get out of bed and go to another room when unable to fall asleep, you know, only come to bed back to bed when you're sleepy again, and try to get up at the same time every morning. CBT also included directions to alter faulty beliefs and misconceptions about, you know, how much sleep they needed, and gave them, helped them develop coping methods for any residual insomnia and managing their worries and anxieties. Patients kept a sleep diary, like you suggested, and underwent sleep lab evaluations at baseline, 6 weeks, and then at the end of the study after 6 months. Using these standardized evaluations, both the CBT and the CBT plus Ambien groups had a similar response and remission rate after 6 weeks. Remission was more common after 6 months in the patients receiving combined CBT plus Zolpidem than in those receiving CBT alone, 56% versus 43%. The number needed to treat there was 8. So the combination at 6 months was a little better. No difference at 6 weeks was a little better at 6 months than the CBT alone. Patients initially treated with the combined treatment who were then randomized to CBT alone actually had remission significantly more often than those who continued to take the Ambien as needed. Number needed to treat there is 4. Response and remission rates were measured by independent observer in a sleep lab, and they weren't any different between any of the treatment groups. So the objectively measured sleep lab kind of outcomes were the same no matter what you did. But if you looked at the patient-reported outcomes, they were better. And really the optimal strategy seemed to be initially a combination of CBT plus the hypnotic Zolpidem for 6 months, and then after that, continuing the CBT without the PRN Ambien. And so, interesting study, a little complicated, but hopefully got that across.
Well, it is complicated, and it is interesting, and it is a very common ambulatory problem. I guess for me, the problem in thinking about this is CBT. And
yeah.
While I know that they have trained mere mortals, meaning us primary care doctors, in CBT, by and large, you need to send someone to a mental health professional for this. And it's hard to find people that know CBT.
So what's a mental health professional anyway, Mike? I listened to your the KCRW Second Opinion podcast that you do, and which I enjoy very much. Do a little cross-promotion here. But you had a nice one about a patient you'd referred for therapy to a therapist, and turned out it wasn't really a therapist at all.
Right. It is, you know, again, I'm not sure how much of that is true across the country, but it is, you know, a big problem in terms of who really is certified and licensed and what's their training.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at one extreme, we've got psychiatrists and psychologists, and no one questions their credentials. But then as you work down from doctoral level training, you end up with people, you know, who really decide one morning that, you know, they've got a gift of gab and they want to call themselves counselors or therapists. And,
yep.
You know, there are no laws to do that. But cognitive behavioral therapy is a very specific skill. It isn't particularly difficult, but it is something that someone needs to be trained in.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find someone who can do this.
It is. And I've had that challenge in you know, Georgia as well, and just to try to find who does what. And, you know, it's not like when you look in the phone book, they describe the school of therapy that they're, you know, that they've adopted, and there are lots of different approaches, and you know, so it can be a challenge. And I think if you do find somebody good, you know, nurture that relationship.
Exactly. Well, good. Very useful information, and we'll talk with you again next week.
Sounds good.
Good. Thanks, Mark.
Yep.
That's this week's poem. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to look at this and other recent poems, please go to www.infopoems.com. Please join us again next week for another medical poem.